Good evening and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the final Lowy Institute event for 2018. I'm Michael Fullilove, the director of the Institute. Before I introduce Barry, let me give a little ad for the Institute, if I may, given that it's our last event for the year. It's been a hugely consequential year for the world, and it's been a big year for the Institute. We've published important research on topics including US grand strategy, Southeast Asia's economy, North Korea's nuclear strategy, threats to stability in the Pacific and elsewhere. In conjunction with Penguin, we've published two of our brilliant new Lowy Institute papers, Remaking the Middle East by Anthony Bubalo, and our newest publication, which is out in time for Christmas, Ideal Stocking Stuffer, America versus the West, Can the Liberal World Order Be Preserved by Corey Sharkey. The Lowy Institute poll provided important insights on Australia's views on the world. Our researchers have been everywhere publishing, putting their views into the debate. The Interpreter continues to host the best debates in the country. And as many of you know, this year we launched two major multi-year digital products, the Asia Power Index, which maps power across Asia, and the Pacific Aid Map, which tracks all the aid that's been given to the Pacific over the last 6 or 7 years. Both of them use digital technology to illuminate huge amounts of data, and both of them are milestones for us. Frank Lowy gave a remarkable Lowy lecture this year. We've hosted many other visitors, including a couple of weeks ago, Susan Glasser and Peter Baker from The New Yorker and The New York Times, respectively. And to cap off a terrific year, we're very delighted to be joined by one of America's most interesting columnists, Barry Weiss. Ladies and gentlemen, Barry grew up in Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania. She graduated from Columbia. She was a Wall Street Journal Bartley Fellow in 2007 and a Dorot Fellow, if I pronounce that correctly, in Jerusalem in 2007 to 2008. She was the news and politics editor at Tablet from 2011 to 2013. I can see her watching what I'm saying very carefully and fact-checking everything. She moved to the Journal in 2000. She moved to the Journal in 2013, and 4 years later she moved to the New York Times as an editor and a writer on column on culture and politics. She's in Australia for a few weeks, thanks to the Times Australian Bureau, and we were lucky enough to lure her here. So, Barry, join us.
I'm so excited to be here.
So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to ask Barry questions for about 20 minutes or half an hour, and then I'm going to give you an opportunity to fire away. So Barry, can I begin by saying, I guess, we were just meeting with some of the colleagues, and I asked Barry for her advice, because it does seem to me it's been a remarkable couple of years for you in the sense that you have really emerged as a really significant voice in the American debate over the last couple of years. So I guess the first question is, what has that been like? And especially to do it when the zeitgeist is perhaps not completely sympathetic to every view you have on the world. So what has that been like? How much fun has it been? How would you do things differently?
I guess I'll just start by saying that I really believe that I have the greatest job in the entire world. I get to go to work every day and debate ideas with other smart people. I have never been diagnosed with ADD, but I suspect that that would be accurate in terms of sort of my intellectual promiscuity. I like talking about different things depending on the day, and this is a job that allows me to do that. I'm here in Australia knowing very little about this beautiful country, and I'm going to get to write about it for the next few weeks of my life. So that's the headline. Loving it, mm-hmm. and it's really been an incredible year and a half since I joined the Times. It's actually only been a year and a half, although it feels like longer.
I told you she was fact-checking me.
But, you know, I'd be lying if I didn't say that it's also disorienting. It's strange to have a kind of straw man, or I don't know what the right word is, but I think that's it, get built, a caricature that gets built, you know, that bears very little resemblance to who you actually are. Uh-huh. But I don't think that's unique to me. I think that that is just the nature of Twitter and social media. And one of the reasons that I believe so strongly in keeping things IRL, as the millennials say, meeting people in real life and getting to know them in a three-dimensional way, which is, of course, you know, the bedrock of what good journalism is about. I think you asked, did you ask here or there in terms of what I would have done differently?
What would you have done differently,
Barry? But I'm going to answer that question. And what I would have done differently is that I just wish that I started running at 100 miles an hour 10 years ago. The reason, the only person to blame for that, of course, is myself. Yep. But one thing I will say about being at the Times that is different than the journal editorial page, which taught me, I mean, taught me skills in a way that is remarkable, like that has carried me through my entire career in terms of thinking creatively about commissioning, in terms of looking for heterodox voices, in terms of just editing a really, really tight and punchy lead, in terms of selling a story. All of those skills I got at the journal editorial page, and for that I'm forever grateful. But it was very much a sort of old boys club feeling. And I generally ascribe to the view that, not that representation doesn't matter, of course it matters, but I don't think I viscerally or emotionally understood it until I came to the Times and all of a sudden I wasn't the only woman in the room. And that actually made a really big difference in terms of helping me overcome my own imposter syndrome, I think Michelle Obama called it recently, which I think is not unique to being a woman is at all, but something that I've certainly suffered from. And I remember very clearly being in different situations at the Journal and thinking, I am the stupidest person in this room, and there is no way that I would be able to write as well as every other person here. And, you know, coming to the Times really, really changed that for me.
Speaking of meeting people IRL and keeping it real, I liked, you had a lovely line in a piece you wrote earlier this month where you, and you began it like this. You said, everything sucks. That's the overwhelming feeling I get when I spend too much time on Twitter. It makes me feel anxious and angry and amped up. And that's on a day when I'm not even trending as a very bad person. So Barry is funny as well, on top of all her other gifts. So tell us, what is it like to trend as a very bad person on Twitter? What's the weirdest...
Have you ever had a panic attack?
Maybe.
Okay,
maybe.
You don't have to admit that.
I'm feeling panicked now that you're asking me about it. But...
If you've ever had a panic attack or an anxiety attack, it physically feels something a little bit like that, or at least it did for me in the beginning. Now, thank God, I've learned how to use it differently. I've learned how to not look at my mentions. I've, you know, just become a lot more disciplined on it. But, you know, when I had the bad tweet, as my family refers to it, it, you know, I was, my face got hot. I was sweating. I wanted to crawl into my bed and not emerge for 48 hours. I mean, that's really what it was like. So it doesn't feel great. But, you know, having been at the Times now for a year and a half, I'm much more aware of when I'm sort of poking the hornet's nest, and I have much more control over it. Sometimes I'll choose to do it, knowing that that will be the response, because I think that the point is important enough, but I don't find myself sort of stumbling into minefields the way that I did in the first 6 months. And frankly, that had a lot to do with the fact that at the Journal, I wasn't on Twitter. You know, this is a really new thing for me. But also that the readership of the Times is just extremely different than the average reader of the Journal editorial page. Things that would not have caused a ruffle, you know, things that would be read by a few thousand people if I published them in the Journal, which I did. You know, I've been writing, you know, things in praise of cultural appropriation and sort of pushing back against the excesses of politically correct culture for years. Like, that's not a new subject for me. But all of a sudden, writing those same things for a readership that had a very different set of political assumptions was causing sort of firestorms that I couldn't have anticipated until I was there for a while and understood our readers better.
Now, one of the issues you've been active on for a long time is free speech and pushing back against the cancel culture a little bit. And we've had a little bit of that in Australia and indeed a little bit of that at the Lowy Institute from time to time where people think that we've invited someone who's beyond the pale mm-hmm. in some way, and they're appalled, and they demand that we disinvite them, and we don't do that. But that's a very hot debate, a much hotter debate, I think, in the United States than it is here. So who's winning that debate in the United States?
I fear that the people who believe in canceling other people are winning. And you saw that, you know, you saw that this week with Kevin Hart, who was supposed to host the Oscars. And now he's not hosting the Oscars. And the reason for it is that, like everyone, probably in this room, but frankly in the world, you know, he made some homophobic jokes, I believe. I don't actually remember exactly what they were. And they were surfaced. But that wasn't the only thing that happened this week. The other thing that happened was, you know, a young quarterback at Oklahoma won the Heisman Trophy. It should have been the best moment of his life. And instead, what was trending were tweets that he had put out when he was 14 and 15 years old that also, I believe, were homophobic. Now, obviously, I don't condone those tweets. I don't share that sentiment at all. But I think that that's a really, really bad place for a culture to be, a place where there is no room for growth or forgiveness, a place where every mistake is there for the taking. And I just, you know, there was a really, I just think that that's just not a good place for us to be. And you see it, I mean, I think the most outlandish episode of this was when the New Yorker, when David Remnick was supposed to interview Steve Bannon at the New Yorker Festival this year. And I really recommend that everyone goes and looks up the letter that he wrote about why they were deciding to disinvite him, because it's basically a hostage letter. He outlines all of the reasons that it's appropriate for the New Yorker to interview probably the most important blood and soil populist nationalist in the world right now, and to grill him publicly, and the service that that does, not just for New Yorker readers, but for the public in general. And then basically there's a line at the end saying, but I'm not going to do that. And what's the reason that he's not going to do that? He's not going to do that because of an outrage storm that took place on Twitter, and where, frankly, and this was kind of the most amazing part, a lot of New Yorker writers and editors participated in it. So it was sort of left wondering, who is the editor of the New Yorker? Is it the outraged public, or is it David Remnick? I want for it to be David Remnick. And you could say that that's, you know, selfish, because I believe editors and writers have a responsibility and should have authority. But, you know, that has to do with also my views about whether or not the New York Times or other publications should give personalized news feeds for people. I don't believe in that. I think it's our job as editors to tell you what's important, not for you to tell us.
I mean, there were voices on both sides within the New Yorker, weren't there? Because Catherine Schultz and others came out and said she was appalled that this was happening.
Yeah.
But Gladwell came out on the other side and said, you know, I thought the point of a literary festival was when you hear from different voices. If you only want to hear from people you agree with, that's called a dinner party in your home. So,
but a lot of people want that, as it turns out.
Yeah. But what is so? What's so? Your view is that the reporters have a responsibility to the title they work for. Is that right?
Yeah,
they shouldn't be undermining their editor. They shouldn't be undermining the newspaper.
Yeah, obviously not. Like, I think that that's just unprofessional and appalling behavior. Frankly, I'll use her word. Mm-hmm. But I think that what we saw in that instance is not unique to the New Yorker, in that there is a sort of civil war playing out in elite media institutions, and the Times is not immune to this, obviously, where you have an old guard, they tend to be older, but not always, who believes in old school journalism, believes in reporting the world as it is and letting the readers decide for themselves. Then you have a younger group, tends to be younger again, but this is not cut and dry, who sort of believes in journalism, it seems to me, as like a socialist realist enterprise, which is to say they believe that a newspaper or a magazine should reflect the world as it ought to be and not the world as it is. That is the way that I understand the outrage at the paper and also in the public around a feature that we ran about the Nazi next door. I believe this was a profile of a guy in Ohio. And here was a guy who loved making pasta with his girlfriend and loved watching Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm. And what do you know? He's also a neo-Nazi. Now, there was a really large, not necessarily large, but a group, a very outspoken group in the paper who felt that this was normalizing the neo-Nazi next door by even writing about him. And you see this logic sometimes play out when it comes to coverage of Trump, that it's somehow normalizing him to write about him. Well, it's like, what are we supposed to do? I'd like someone of that view to explain to me what the line is between reporting on something, which is what we do, that is the whole enterprise, and normalizing it. So I don't think that the instance that played out with Steve Bannon, The New Yorker, is at all unique to The New Yorker. I think it's playing out, I think it's playing out at the Times, at the Journal, at all sorts of places. And I do not think it's a secret about, you know, which side I'm on in that.
But if this is mainly generational, but not exclusively, but mainly generational, what does it mean for the future of journalism? Because I did feel when Remnick caved after sort of 2 hours of nasty tweets, I really thought there goes another giant redwood falling in the forest. Mm-hmm. I mean, what does it mean? If the New Yorker can be cowed in 2 hours over this kind of thing, where are we going to be in 10 years with these big mastheads when some of the olds that you mentioned have died off and retired?
Well, I put a lot of hope in the current young publisher of the New York Times, A.G. Sulzberger, who, you know, is responsible for me and others being at the paper, is responsible for pushing the notion that, you know, the editorial page of a great newspaper should not be a warm bath for its readers, but should challenge them and show them the spectrum of debate going on in a society. So I'm really, really happy that he's the publisher of the Times, and I'm grateful for that, at least for myself. But I'd be lying if I said that these things didn't scare me. You know, the same people that are ragging rightly on the Republican Party for showing no spine and courage when it comes to standing up to Donald Trump, and indeed they have shown no spine or courage, you know, with very, 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 very rare exception, and mostly when they're retiring, like Jeff Flake, I'd like to see some courage on the part of people like David Remnick in standing up to some nasty tweets.
Now, I'm glad you brought up Donald Trump.
I was wondering how long it would take for us to get there.
How much of all this nonsense can we blame on President Trump?
Which nonsense?
Well, all of it. I mean, all of these things. I mean, to what extent has his election really stoked a lot of these fires? I mean, they were there before, but to what extent has he really turned up the heat on them?
A lot. Mm-hmm. We were talking about in the other room before. I mean, there's some positive elements to him being elected, some positive fallouts. Like, I don't think that the Me Too movement, for whatever its excesses and warts, would have happened without Donald Trump being elected. I think in large part it's a sort of reaction to the fact that enough Americans felt that, you know, for all of his other denigration of different groups, that we could elect a man to the highest office in the land to be the leader of the free world who bragged about grabbing women by the genitalia. I think that outraged a lot of people. And I think that, you know, just the emotional outpouring led to, you know, some positive change, like parts of the Me Too movement. I definitely also feel that that there's a sense that emotions are running so, so high right now. And I think that there's a lot of like rageful, understandably, energy on the left. And I think that there's also a sense of political impotence. And so I understand a lot of the sort of fire that gets trained on people who are 10% to the right, let's say, of the sort of the left, as fascists, as white supremacists, as crypto-Nazis, when actually they're just conservatives, is the result of the fact that they can't do very much about Donald Trump and the actual threat. And I see those two things as being quite related.
Now, how long is the Trump moment going to last, do you think? What are his chances of being reelected?
Oof. You need someone much smarter than me to answer that. But I would say, honestly, if I had to bet at the moment, I would say he's going to be reelected. I just don't see a Democrat. Trust me, that's a nightmare for me. But although good for New York Times business and probably good for the Lowy Institute.
Good for Mr. Sulzberger.
I don't see a Democrat out there that could beat him. A lot of the people who, like, what do they stand for, right? Like, who are the main front runners right now? Cory Booker, you know, Kirsten Gillibrand. These are chameleons who are basically Julia Louise Dreyfus in Veep. and who have, you know, with Gillibrand specifically, it's like she's gone from being a blue dog pro-gun Democrat in a matter of years to talking about the intersectional wave. I mean, it's like, it's really, I mean, with her specifically, it's quite amazing. Like, she actually is Veep, and I want, maybe I'll write that, but someone needs to write that article. Are people going to vote for that? Like, I think it's quite amazing to me, right? Because you have a Republican Party who's basically given up on the uplifting American story, right? The story of
largeness.
Bigness. Mm-hmm. Of we are, you know, what Reagan talked about. We are the shining city on a hill. We have a nationalism that's unique in human history, a nationalism that doesn't care about your blood or your pedigree or where you're born or who your parents are, but you can become, you know, you can have an enormous life and an enormous life for your family in this country. That's the America that, at its best, the Republican Party used to talk about, a sort of soaring vision that was inclusive and that talked about opportunity. Now what do you have from the right? You have American carnage. You have a vision of, you know, of foreigners coming to the border bearing diseases that have been eradicated 30 years ago, but you wouldn't know that if you were watching Sean Hannity on Fox News at night. Hmm. What's up for the taking right now, and what is so amazing to me that I don't see Democrats grabbing, is that American story. Instead, they're sort of giving in to this mushy, intersectional, interlocking systems of oppression, victimhood, caste system, mush. I don't see them taking up that grand narrative, which is up for grabs. And I think the person that's able to do that is going to be successful, because by and large, I still think Americans believe in that vision.
One of the things that's a bit dispiriting when you go to the United States is to realize how much Mr. Trump dominates daily politics. That's the thing that I find difficult. That every day, I mean, he is like the puppet master, and everybody is reacting constantly to Mr. Trump. So that's the thing that drains me of optimism a bit. I mean, I look at someone like Beto O'Rourke, and I think, well, at least there you've got energy and you've got optimism. But of course, there's going to be so many Democratic candidates on the other side. And then they're confronting someone like Mr. Trump. I mean, presidents tend to get reelected when they run for office.
We know what doesn't win, right? What doesn't win is like the Elizabeth Warren strategy of taking the bait and getting, you know, 23andMe testing and proving that she's 1/60th Native American or whatever that was. Taking the bait doesn't work. I truly believe, and call me a Pollyanna, in the greatest Michelle Obama line of those 8 years. When they go low, we go high. Mm-hmm. People, Barack Obama won the presidency. I know people forget that, but he did. Mm. And he did that based on a rhetoric that was inclusive and enlarging and inspiring. And that still happened in America not too long ago. Mm. I know Trump is sort of dominating the whole landscape. So I really do believe that that's possible again, but I don't think it's possible by getting into the gutter with him, because he will always win. He will always win in the gutter.
Right. Who else would like to ask Barry a question?
Jan Murray. Thank you, Barry, and welcome.
Namaste.
I know it was before your time, but I'm terribly interested in the culture of the New York Times during the 2016 election. And is there any mea culpa about the way they put their finger on the scales apropos Hillary's emails to help Donald Trump get elected? I hope there is.
Do you mean in terms of, I just want to make sure I'm understanding, in terms of the hyper-focus on
that? It was an obsession with the New York Times during the 2016 election, Hillary's emails.
Well, it was an obsession of Donald Trump, right? And they had to focus on... Yeah, I'm aware. I would say that the big come-to-Jesus feeling was over the fact that almost no one at the newspaper could have foreseen Trump winning. And why is that? And what are our blind spots in terms of coverage? And what stories are we missing in the country? You know, how is it that so many smart people at the greatest newspaper in the world could not have seen this coming? And that certainly, you know, is playing out even now in terms of the kind of stories that are being assigned and who's being hired. And definitely in terms of emphasis on Hillary's email, there are New York Times reporters here from the news side who can answer that better than me. And you can corner them over wine after. There's one right there who was raising her hand for a question.
But Barry, just to follow up at a slightly higher level, I mean,
sure.
what a lot of people have criticized the Times for in 2016
yeah.
is in its effort to be objective and balanced and fair to both sides, it was treating the stories on both sides with sort of equal weight. But in fact, the problems on Mr. Trump's side were much, much graver than the problems on Hillary Clinton's side.
Yeah, well, I think, but a huge part of that, right, and a huge part of, like, why did Morning Joe and all of these other reputable shows on MSNBC and CNN and, of course, Fox, but that's Trump TV, and I regard that as a separate thing, give him hours, you know, I forget how much, billions of dollars of free airtime. In large part, like people at the Times, everyone regarded him as a joke. No one thought that this man was going to become president of the United States. He is the host of The Apprentice, and he is the commander-in-chief of the greatest military power in the world. It's still insane. Like, I still cannot get over it some mornings when I wake up. So everyone's to blame for that. But, you know, who saw it coming? Michael Moore? I mean, like, there was just so few people. He did, actually. There were so few people that saw it coming. My mom was one of them. My mom, because she sells carpet in the sort of suburb. I'm from Pittsburgh, right, which is a city in Pennsylvania. You guys know that. Why am I saying this? And but anyway, for her work, she has to drive 2 hours outside of the city to what is regarded as, you know, for sure Trump country. And she would call me and say, Barry, I know you're going to think I'm nuts, but everywhere I'm going, there are these giant homemade signs. You know, people have taken hours of their life to paste the side of their barns with pro-Trump signs. There's something serious going on here. So the fact that, you know, the news is largely reported from urban centers by people who went to Ivy League universities, that's the bigger problem.
All right.
Hi.
That's the woman you can corner.
Jamie Tarabay. Hi. I've got you. Barry, one of the first things that you wrote that I loved and I thought you and I would get along very well was a piece that infuriated so many people. I know you'll be shocked at that. But it was the one about Aziz Ansari, how he was guilty of not being able to read a woman's mind. And I know that this came in the middle of so much, I guess, social media mob justice, right? In the middle of every accusation against any male, no matter how egregious or not, it became this, everyone was accused, everyone was Harvey Weinstein, there was no mitigation, and I really felt like it was trial by media and no due process. And on the other side of that, you have a lot of people who are very fierce advocates of the Me Too movement saying there's going to be a backlash, prepare for the backlash. And so it's easy to dismiss any criticism of the Me Too movement by women mm-hmm. as backlash. Mm-hmm. But I really push against the idea that it's somehow become defined as crimes against women by men. Like, that's it. And it's very clear. And my question really is, where do you see this going? And, I mean, like, how do we mitigate it? Because there's no due process in so many of these cases.
Oh, I'm thinking about Australia right now. And so I'm interested in the Me Too
just
movement.
Just trawling for column ideas.
Yeah. I'm interested in the Me Too movement here and why it hasn't taken off. And the fact that you guys have these defamation laws that really, really puts the burden on the accuser. So that's where my mind is at the moment. But I'm going back to Aziz, and I'm thinking about the Me Too movement. And I think, you know, I think the main thing that I've been hammering for a while, and I'm like a hardcore feminist. I have been since I'm 11 years old. I'm the oldest of four girls. The idea that women, the whole notion, right, of believe women or believe all women, which was sort of the hashtag and slogan of this movement in the beginning, rankled me as a feminist, right? Because the whole feminist idea is that women are human beings, just like men, and we're flawed just like men, or in different ways, but also flawed. And the idea that women, it was almost like Victorian, right? Like that women are these like creatures on a pedestal who are beyond reproach, who never lie, who never, you know, drag up something in order to, you know, out of vengeance, let's say. That just, to me, was deeply anti-feminist. And, you know, you certainly saw that in the Anthony Bourdain and Asia Argento story. And I wrote a column about that called, like, headline, Women Are Still Human Beings. And that's sort of the line that I've taken the whole time. The thing that I think is significant is that people, and I, and this is a credit to the Me Too movement, whatever its faults, women, the mores, I hope, are changing in terms of what people think is normal, right? What's normal is what a culture decides is normal. And if you're in an industry where it's normal to sleep with someone to get a job, or normal to put up with someone grabbing your tush, you know, on a daily basis, and for you not to complain about it, hell yeah, I don't want that to be normal. You know, it shouldn't be. But I think that things have cooled now to the point where if I wrote the Aziz Ansari thing in this moment, I think that the reaction would be quite different. At least I hope that it would be. But I think that, you know, not believe women, it's trust women and trust women's stories and understand that in the scheme of history, what has happened in the past 2 years is really radical and exciting in terms of women talking about these things for the first time. And I still think that that's really, really important.
My name is Alexander Galanos. I've just come back from living in New York for 5 years.
Okay.
Read your stuff over there. My take on that is that we really are living in the age of offense, in that anything that happens, we automatically think what our reaction would be and how we react.
Mm-hmm.
I've got 1,000 questions I'd love to ask you, but just since we're talking about, I know, I'll stick to it.
Mm-hmm.
Christine Blasey Ford, Judge Kavanaugh,
oof,
the midterms.
You're killing me.
Yeah.
Okay.
I agree, and not for normative reasons. I believe that Trump will be reelected. But for 2024, do you think, based on the midterms and his likely reelection, how do you see the whole Blasey Ford, Judge Kavanaugh? I mean, this is really into the heart of the Me Too movement, and it's actually political consequences. So I'm just, you know, curious for your thoughts on that one.
Well, if we look at who's the right-wing Democrat that won in West Virginia, Joe Manchin. You know, Joe Manchin basically won that because he supported Kavanaugh. And I think that we were talking about this in the room before. I cannot think of a moment in the past 2 years in which emotions ran as high as during the Kavanaugh the hearings, but then also, you know, I was talking before about, I was away with like one of my best friends that weekend. And in the end, we sort of politically, policy-wise, we ended up in the same place. I felt like it was pretty clear that he was lying during the investigation about his drinking habits and any number of things. Bringing up the Clintons was beneath the behavior of a Supreme Court judge. And he was perhaps, you know, does not remember the night and blacked out, but I just felt it was beneath someone who was supposed to serve on the Supreme Court. But even expressing any kind of hesitation was extremely hard for this friend of mine who felt like that was in some way apologizing for someone who had at the very least attempted rape. So I'm interested, and I was telling Michael before, I started writing a piece about their marriages that are breaking up over Brett Kavanaugh. You know, truly. I mean, like, it really was tearing people apart in the way that Trump did, but possibly even in a more sort of emotionally intense way. And I'll just speak to my own experience. And one of the things I think is really important as a writer, but just also as a person, which is I went to a prep school not unlike the one that Brett Kavanaugh went to, although it was co-ed. And I was not cool. And I was definitely, you know, a nerdy girl who was bullied by people exactly like the way Brett Kavanaugh and his friends were described. And the emotional reaction that I had was extremely intense, like the visceral feeling that I had about his kind and who he was. But that visceral reaction, that's only the starting point. That can't lead, that's not logic, right? That doesn't tell me what happened on that particular night with Christine Blasey Ford, even though I have a bias in a particular direction and the bias is toward her. I don't think it's American, frankly, or reasonable to try someone based on their pedigree or based on, you know, the kind of milieu they're in. And I felt like there was a lot of that happening around it, understandably, because a lot of women like me have had experiences with people like that. But that's something certainly in myself and definitely in my writing I try and mitigate against.
Barry, let me ask you on that broad, if I can go a little bit broader on that topic, that like everything in life, like everything else in life, the Trump presidency will pass. One of these days
it will be over.
I mean,
but it's going to pass, but we don't know if he's going to like bring down the free world.
Okay, but if he doesn't bring down the free world, right, and if, as we decided earlier, that a lot of these bad things that are happening are Mr. Trump's fault, to what extent will those bad things be mitigated once he goes? To what extent can America as a country snap back to normality? Whether it's the way the Republican Party has comported itself and gone from believing in alliances and believing in
markets,
immigration, and all those kinds of things, to really signing up to the Trump agenda, whether it's some more of the social movements that have really been amped up and energized by Mr. Trump, to what extent will it snap back, or to what extent has something broken? How much of these changes are reversible, do you think?
Well, first of all, Trump is a symptom of something that was broken that I don't think that we recognized fully. And now he's also catalyzing further brokenness. So he's both of those things, actually. I don't think it's a snapback situation as much as I would love for it to be. Obviously, if he doesn't get reelected, it's better, because I really, really loathe to think about what the country is going to look like after 6 more years of this. If he's reelected, that's dark. That's a really hard thing to imagine. I think Maureen Dowd wrote one of the great columns sort of to answer this question, which was called Trump Shows the Way. I think that was the headline. You guys, if you Google Maureen Dowd, Trump Shows the Way, it will come up. And her insight was that Trump shows the way in the negative on everything. Where he is indecent, we have to be decent. Where he is uncivilized, we have to be civil. Where he shows sort of preying on the weak, denigrating heroes like John McCain, and, you know, obviously the Gold Star soldiers during the campaign. I could go on and on and on. We'd be here for hours. We have to be the opposite. And I think it's a really unique moment in the sense that most people I know don't have very much faith, not just in Trump, but in politics in general in America right now. I look out, you know, I mentioned Cory Booker, Kirsten Gillibrand. I could name 20 others. I don't see them leading as much as I see us leading. And I really feel like one of the positives, if you can say that, of the Trump presidency is it's changed certainly the way that I try and comport myself in the world. Like, I really try personally to be an anti-Trump, you know, and to what extent can we all be that? I don't have a lot of faith in our political systems right now, but I think that there can be change, civil society, whatever that means, in our communities and in our lives and the way that we relate to one another.
That's a nice note. The gentleman at the back I saw.
Thank you very much. I'm Paul Warbank. I'm news editor at media and marketing website Mumbrella. Two questions, if I may. First, going back earlier, Barry, to your comment about Trump getting inordinate amounts of media time, how much would you put that down to journalists' KPIs around clicks and page views and so on? And the second part of it is, how much responsibility would you put on platforms like Twitter, Facebook, and Google on Trump's ascendancy?
Great question. For the second one, this woman in the front row is a great person to talk to afterward because she writes about tech and culture for the Times. But for the first one, you know, the old phrase, right, used to be, if it bleeds, it leads. Now it's just, if it's Trump, it sells. You know, it just does. And that's a real tension because obviously he's the most powerful man in the world and we have to write about it. But there are other stories that are hugely important. And I think that, like, I'll give you a personal example. You guys see sort of 20% of what my job is in what I write and debates and public appearances and things like that. But the other 80% of my job is commissioning and editing op-eds for the Times and specifically bringing in voices that might not otherwise be in the paper. I know that numbers matter to some extent, even though it's really not emphasized at the paper. And I know that if I'm going to get pieces slagging on Donald Trump, they're always going to go to trending, you know, number, whatever we call it now, most popular. It's my job as an editor to resist that, you know, and to say, you know what? People should really be reading about the genocide of Uyghur Muslims in China, you know, something that most people don't know about. People should be reading about, you know, Dragonfly at Google. People should be reading about any number of things. And it's the job of the editor, frankly, not to get lazy and not give in to the quick heroin hit almost, and to sort of stay sober. And I think that responsibility really lies in the hands of editors. Thankfully, in my experience, there's a lot of people like that who I work with. But I'm going to tell you, like, the Uyghur Muslim op-ed is going to get 50,000 reads and, you know, a column saying that Donald Trump is, you know, the end of the free world as we know it is going to get millions. So there's certainly
I've got a piece like that I'm going
to send. So there's just such an incentive, as you know, as someone who's in the business.
Thanks, Barry. My name is Misha Sol. How new is the Trump phenomenon in terms of the catastrophizing? You know, I was in high school for most of the time. Bush was in power. But, you know, that was the end of times as far as
totally.
A lot of people are concerned. He was reelected. It was, you know, a joke on the cover of Le Monde. You know, wars, offshore, you know, budget increases. It wasn't this idealized small market, you know, American Republican Party. It was, you know, partnering with the evangelicals and game over. It was a disaster. So how much is it kind of media fixated on his every move versus a structural shift and decline in America?
I think it is a structural shift, but I think you're speaking to something that I'm hyper aware of and I think is a huge failing of the press. I mean, like, if you go back and read the way that George H.W. Bush was written about when he was president, even that was the end of the world. And yet when he's dead, it's like, actually, he was a pretty good guy, pretty reasonable, pretty gentlemanly. You know, when I think about the way that, you know, Bush or even Romney was talked about as if it was like the end of the world and, you know, there's just like a degradation of language at a certain point. It's like, what does it, you know, when you call Mitt Romney, you know, the cleanest, you know, Republican, the most sort of upstanding, decent person, regardless of what you think of his politics, if he's like, you know, a fascist, what does that make Donald Trump? And I think one of the reasons, I think in a way, one of the reasons that we were unable to talk about Trump or really unable to sound the alarm sufficiently about him is because those words had been all hollowed out already, right? And you see that even now. I mean, I'm focused on it a lot on the left, which is, you know, I'm called often, you know, a fascist. Okay. If I'm a fascist, what does that make Viktor Orban? What does that make the actual fascists that are rising all over the world? And it's not just like it hurts me to be called a fascist because, frankly, it doesn't. I know that I'm not. But it's really, really dangerous because there is actual fascism rising in the world at this moment in a very, very, very scary way. And we want to preserve that language to signify to the public that we're serious about it when we use it. And I think that there's just a sloppiness with these words that get thrown around that the press falls prey to. And I try not to, but I think you're speaking to something that is true and that I think a lot about.
Hi, Barry. Hi. My name is Adrian Ewan. I'm a huge fan of yours.
We emailed.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah.
Thanks for responding, by the way.
No, I'm just so happy.
You seem to know everybody.
No, we emailed.
One of the pieces that you wrote throughout this year was on the so-called intellectual dark web. Now, I have two parts of a question that you might want to answer. Quick parts.
We can talk after, too.
Yeah.
And also we can meet because I'm here for a month.
Mm. So what do you think would be the future impact of the intellectual dark web? And do you think that impact would further, you know, penetrate different layers of the culture wars.
The culture wars?
Yes.
And also explain to everyone what the intellectual dark web is, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, here I'm going to throw to another person in the audience who you can corner after, which is Claire, who edits Quillette, which I think is the signal publication of what's been called the intellectual dark web. The intellectual dark web is a, I don't know if we'd call it a movement or a collection of thinkers. There's a lot of scientists specifically in it. It's people like Sam Harris, like the Weinstein brothers, like Jordan Peterson is a member of it. I could go on down the list. You could just Google this article that I wrote. But they're people who view themselves as sort of being pushed out, I don't want to phrase it in a victim way. Let me think about how to phrase this. Who are having a conversation about ideas that have wrongly been categorized as dangerous or taboo in the mainstream. So they talk about things in an open way, like evolutionary biology or the idea maybe that gender is not just a social construct. I could go down the list. Things that have become increasingly hard to talk about in mainstream publications for any number of reasons. And they're having their own offline conversations in places like Quillette. But then also, and this is the part that I see as most maybe interesting about it, is thinking about the intellectual dark web as a kind of publishing phenomenon, which is to say, the way that public conversations happen on places like CNN and MSNBC is extremely unnatural. You have blocks of 6 and 8 minutes where four people are lined up and everyone gets their 45 seconds to say their smart thing. That's not how anyone talks in real life. And it's assuming, frankly, that viewers are really, really stupid. And actually, what the intellectual dark web proves at its best is that people are smart and sophisticated and they want to go to auditoriums and hear people talk for 3 hours about the nature of free will. That's profound. And one way that they're getting to people is through podcasting and through YouTube and all kinds of channels that just didn't exist 10 or 20 years ago. So I think it's an extremely interesting phenomenon. I don't see it, I think one of the best parts of it is that they're having conversations about controversial things in a civil way, which is pathetic that that seems radical, but it sort of does in this current moment. I'm not sure if it's a movement, though. When I wrote that article, I did think that, but I'm not sure, because I'm not sure if there's a will to political power. Maybe there is, but I see increasingly each member of it sort of breaking out and doing their own thing. So in terms of the culture war, I think it's definitely having an effect on it, and it's a longer conversation, but I'm happy to talk about that later.
Hi, Peter Green. Do we think that the age of reason has transformed into the age of Twitter, and that I think, therefore I am, has simply been replaced with
I feel,
therefore I am? And is this going to give us the tyranny of the masses?
Oof. Who are you?
Someone you don't know in the audience.
I know. I didn't pay for this person. I fear that it is, but I'm heartened by the pockets of reason that I see, and I see a huge part of my job as elevating those voices. And this is a strange analogy, but go with me. Harvey Milk, who was the gay mayor of San Francisco, right? He used to talk about why you have to come out as a gay person. And the reason you have to come out is almost less for yourself, but more to give courage to other people to do the same. You know, to the kid living in a rural place who doesn't know anyone who's gay and is being discriminated against by his family and by his school. That's a little bit what I think about when I think about people coming out as free thinkers or coming out as not being doctrinaire. I think the more people that sort of raise their head above the parapet and say, I don't agree with everything, and I want to talk about it. Again, it sounds sad that that's unique right now, but it is. But I'm seeing more and more people coming out and saying that. And I think that that's building to something quite powerful.
One question I wanted to ask you, Barry, is you wrote this
this lovely conversation with Eve Pizer, if I pronounce that correctly, yeah. Where, I mean, perhaps dealing with, you know, trying to compensate for some of the problems with Twitter, you went out of your way, I guess, to actually meet up and befriend someone who had been who'd been poking you on Twitter. And you said you used to watch on Twitter, you used to watch her with a sort of suspicious side eye. But then when you actually went swimming with her and hung out with her, she was quite fun. So is that a good antidote for those of us who are getting amped up and anxious? Should we be getting out there IRL and
having beer summits?
Yeah.
Yes. I really think so. I mean, obviously there are limits to that. You know, I don't think it's reasonable for, you know, a Jew in Pittsburgh to go have a beer with, you know, the man who shot up the synagogue where I was bat mitzvahed. I don't think a black student in Charlottesville should go meet with Richard Spencer. You know, there are obvious limits to this kind of thing. But most of us actually get enraged by people who are like in our orbit and only slightly to the left or the right of us, which has to do with something that we wrote about in the piece, which is this, you know, idea of the narcissism of small differences. It's like anyone who's slightly to the left of me is a heretic. Anyone who's slightly to the right of me is a fanatic. That's true, you know, certainly true in Judaism, you know, and but it's definitely in terms of the way we Jews think about one another. But I think it's definitely true politically. And I think that oftentimes the most outrage is reserved for the people who are sort of next door to us. And I think that does make a difference. I think getting offline and realizing that people are human and three-dimensional is quite important to staying human.
Let me ask you, you mentioned your Jewishness and you mentioned the Tree of Life Synagogue. And for those of you who haven't read it, Barry wrote a really beautiful and very moving column in the Times after the awful attack at that synagogue. She also wrote a very powerful op-ed a couple of weeks ago about the rise of anti-Semitism in Europe, keyed off a CNN poll. How new is that? I mean, okay, anti-Semitism is the oldest story there is, but is there something new and particularly worrying that we should be focused on? And I mean, that second column was a lot about living your life in a closet if you're a European Jew. Mm-hmm. But to what extent did the attack in Pittsburgh, if any, did it change your sort of perceptions of being Jewish in the United States? Has that brought it home in a new way or not?
Oof. Okay, which part do you want me to answer first?
Chronologically, okay. Please.
So let's start with Europe. And I think that, you know, I describe what's going on in Europe as a three-headed dragon. And we're starting to see that same dragon, at least the buds, you know, the start of it, certainly in the States. And, you know, it's that there's anti-Semitism very obviously, you know, from the political right and the rise of the sort of new blood and soil nationalism, which hates Jews for being globalists, which hates the fact that we have a tradition of embracing the refugee and the foreigner for all of the sort of universal values that we pride ourselves on. That's why the right, you know, singles us out. Then you have radical Islam in Europe, which is a bigger problem than it is in the States. And then you have anti-Semitism from the far left, which often masquerades itself as anti-Zionism. And this is the sort of anti-Semitism of Jeremy Corbyn and his ilk, people who insist that they are anti-racist and yet have this incredible blind spot when it comes to the Jews. So that's, I think, what's so difficult about this moment is that you have all three sort of brewing in this cauldron. We see that in the States, certainly. I think, you know, it's very easy for Jews to call out anti-Semitism on the political right, both because we ourselves are largely liberal, I mean, overwhelmingly so, and because of our history, you know, most recently, obviously, with the Nazis, we've experienced a lot of anti-Semitism from the political right. We have an instinct for it. We know it immediately. When we see the Charlottesville marcher shouting, "Jews will not replace us," it's like, okay, this is an old story for us. It's harder from the political left because those are the people that we're friends with. Those are the people whose tastes and aesthetic and politics we generally share. But that's why I think it's so important to be calling it out. And, you know, there's, I sometimes get pushback from that where it's like, it's so much worse on the right. Why aren't you only focusing on the right? Well, obviously I am focused on the right too, but 15 or 20 years ago, when Jews in Europe were sounding the alarm about anti-Semitism there, people dismissed them largely as being hysterical. And now you don't know, you know, I don't know a French Jewish family that hasn't bought a second apartment in Tel Aviv or Montreal that can afford it. So when people tell me I'm being hysterical, it's like, no, better to catch the cancer at stage one than at stage four. In terms of Pittsburgh, you have to sort of lack imagination to not imagine that something like that would be possible, both because of the fact of our insane gun situation in the States. Another thing I admire Australia for that I want to read more about is how you guys have dealt with that problem. I just think it's absolutely insane that someone so evil, mentally ill, unclear, I frankly haven't read that much about the man who committed the massacre, the fact that he, you know, had four weapons on him that day, including an AR-15. It just seems insane. So having spent a lot of time in Israel, you know, during the Second Intifada, and I had imagined not that specifically happening, but, you know, you have to sort of have your head in the sand to not imagine that it could be possible. It doesn't mean that it wasn't incredibly shocking, and it shook me in a way that I was surprised by. These are people that, you know, were the sort of most stalwart, loving members of the Jewish community of Pittsburgh. They were the people who showed up. You know, most Jews on a Saturday morning, it's a very long service. We show up at 11, we stay for 30 minutes, then we have, like, you know, the rogalach afterward. These are the people that showed up at 9:30, you know, to set things up. So those are the kinds of people who were killed. I think one last thing I'll say, which is there was a lot of conversation in the wake of that attack about, you know, is Donald Trump an anti-Semite, or to what extent has he contributed to it? I don't know what's in his heart. I don't think that the person, you know, father of a woman who converted to Orthodox Judaism, spends a lot of time hating Jews. However, Trump is given to conspiracy-minded thinking, and he contributes to it. And any environment, any politics in which conspiracy thinking is in force never ends well for the Jews, because anti-Semitism is not just a normal bigotry. It's a conspiracy theory, you know, and in which any society's sort of most loathsome qualities are put on to the character of the Jew, which is why under communism, the Jews were the uber capitalists. In Nazi Germany, they're the race contaminators, you know, on the far left right now, you know, for whom white colonialism, as they understand it, is sort of the last sin of the West, Israel becomes, you know, the Jew among the nations. So I think that any atmosphere in which conspiracy thinking like QAnon and whatever else is thriving is one that will not end well for the Jews.
All right, we're almost out of time. I'm going to take one more question if there's somebody else.
The main thrust at the end of all of this against all the international politics has been for me the, you mentioned at the start both ADHD, which I have, and that's fun, depersonalization, and also panic attacks. And they're largely related to the not IRL. My question essentially would be to, you're an opinions editor, but there's no instructions like a recipe for how to live with the technology that is destroying us, such as, you know, Twitter has entire departments dedicated just to making us stay on the page.
Yep.
It's not in just insidious, it is pernicious, essentially. We don't know how to, the only reason I haven't checked my phone is because my battery's flat. How do we...
Also, you're very funny.
It's crawling. Don't get me wrong. But I would love to take pictures. I want to take pictures of the food. I want to do everything.
And ask questions.
Indeed. How do we...
Right. It's a little drug in your pocket.
Indeed. Also, drugs in my purse. Drugs everywhere. how do we... I find myself... I only write when my phone is flat and I'm not talking to my friends, or I'm not on Twitter, or I'm not on Facebook, and I'm not anything else. How do we...
You seem like someone that should get a flip phone.
Indeed. Absolutely. I know. Like, what's the show with the bikers? I don't know. But Or no phone at all. When I lose my phone, I get angry for a couple of minutes and then I'm joyous. How do we...
This is the question.
I get it.
Okay, yeah, how do we go from the unreality and road rage that essentially is Twitter and all those platforms where it's not face-to-face, where you would apologize, where you do any other manner of human things and see your face. How do we get back to, like, how do we just...
Right.
We need teachers to... That's it.
Sorry. Okay.
Thank you.
I love that question.
You had time to think of an answer.
I did. So. No, well, I just think that if there's a story that's bigger than Donald Trump, it's that. It's how this is changing what it means to be human and how we don't even fully understand what that is. Like, we're monkeys that need to touch other people, you know, and be around other human beings and be social. And this is allowing us to sit for, you know, God knows how many hours like the incels spend on their phone or gaming all day long, totally disconnected from reality. I don't know the answer to it. I can tell you some strategies that I've used in my own life, but the way that you described your relationship to your phone, I think is honest. And I think if most of us are honest with ourselves, it functions. The only analogy that makes sense is like a really, really, really addictive drug. I don't know. Maybe we're going to have AA groups for technology. Seriously. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. I know that I read this one book called 10 Arguments for Deleting Your Social Media Accounts Right Now by Jaron Lanier, which I mentioned in that piece. And it definitely helped me sort of see my own behavior from 10,000 feet and see the way that engagement was actually just this negative feedback loop that you described. I don't know the answer to it, but I think if there's a story that's bigger than Trump and what Trumpism is doing to the states, it's this one and what these companies are doing to us and changing what it means, what human beings are.
Ladies and gentlemen, friends of Barry Weiss, relatives, ring-ins, thank you very much.
Thanks for coming to this dinner party.
Let me say it's been an unusual event for the Lowy Institute because we're usually looking outside our borders, but it's been one of the most interesting and fun events of the year. And that comes down to Barry, who is not a very bad person, despite what you might read on Twitter. Barry said that in her life she's trying to be the anti-Trump, and I think if that means being intelligent and informed and charming and funny, you're succeeding.
Thank you.
So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you again to Barry Weiss. And I also want to thank everybody here who came, especially those not related by blood to anyone on the stage. But not just for coming tonight, but in fact for coming to our events throughout the year. We have a terrific community of people who are interested in our work. We really appreciate it. We wish you the best for the holiday season. We're going to see you in 2019 for many more terrific events. Thank you very much.
Thank you.